You to turn as we start to Ephesians chapter 4, verse 20. Paul is saying some things to the Christians at Ephesus. He has just gotten done saying in the few verses before this about the Gentiles, and by Gentiles in this context, he means not just non-Jews, but really the unconverted people, those who are not yet Christians. And he's making some very general statements about them, and that historically this is how they are. They're darkened in their understanding. They're separated from the life of God, many of them having become callous in that lifestyle and therefore resistant of the glory of the gospel, etc. But verse 20 says, "But you did not learn Christ in this way, if indeed you have heard him and have been taught in him, just as truth is in Jesus, that in reference to your former manner of life, you lay aside the old self, which is being corrupted in accordance with the lusts of deceit, and that you be renewed in the spirit of your mind." Well, we're going to focus on the laying aside the old self part in this lesson. Next week, we'll talk about the renewing part, okay? But I want to examine this old self thing because I'm not certain that we're all on the same page when we talk about this. I'm not sure, if you remember last lesson, that we're all speaking God's language, so to speak, right? That we're all using the same terms in the same way. My intent here is not just to learn a concept and then we all walk away unchanged and go eat lunch and forget about it all. Rather, to learn instead what God is teaching us and then to put that into practice, that is the intent of this lesson, to be transformed by the renewing of our minds. And so we want to look at this old self concept. Yeah, we do, but we also want to understand, what do I need to do about that? Notice he says that you laid aside this old self, and you might get from that single passage or that single phrase there that it's all up to you. You're the one in charge. You're the one that laid it aside. You're the one that has full control. And the fact is, you do have control over all this. It is your decision, but it's not your power. We're saved always by our decision to be saved. That's true. But we're not saved only by that decision. It is the decision that needs to be made. It's true. But it's also the power of God that needs to actually change us from what we are into what we need to be. So you don't do this apart from God. You don't do this apart from his help. It's incorrect to say that. So the decision for laying aside the old self comes from you. God doesn't do it for you. Just as the decision for putting on the new self is your decision, God doesn't do that for you either. You created the old self. It's not something God created for you to be. It's not something God created for you. You are the master of the old self. Or you were the master of that old self. Therefore, you are in an exclusive position to lay that old self aside. You do have control over who you are. And if there's anything I want you to come away from in a lesson like this, is to recognize that you do have control over what's going to happen to you. Not only in this life, to the extent, and we're talking about your spiritual life, of course, not only in this life, but also in the life to come. You have full control over where you're going to be. If you're going to be with God or if you're not going to be with God, you have full control over that right now. You will not have control over that in the life to come. So the decision that needs to be made in the here and now. You are responsible. You and I are responsible to lay aside the old self, and we are responsible to put on the new self. While you and I created the old self, it's God who creates the new self. That's not something you came up with. That's not something you create. That's not something you, put into practice on your own and come up with the terms and conditions of what the old or the new self rather looks like. That's something God does for you and then tells you, here it is, now you just need to put it on. And if it was all up to you, if you think about it, well, we wouldn't need God. We would just simply say, hey, I got a problem, but don't worry, God, I can handle this. I've got this and I'm going to take care of this and then I'll see you in heaven, right? I mean, if that were the case, we wouldn't need him. We wouldn't need the blood of Christ. We wouldn't need to remember his sacrifice. We wouldn't need to preach or anything. We'd just say, okay, we're all smart people, right? We can figure this out psychologically, mentally. We can come to a conclusion and we can go from there. That's just not the case, though. And this whole series that we started in January, the first week in January, this change of mind and heart, is devoted to getting us to an understanding that there are things we need to do, but there's also things that God must do for you, and you've got to let him do it. And on that note, before I go on into the lesson itself, I realize that some of you are not ready for what I'm going to talk about here. And it's not because you don't need it. And it's not because you can't do it. And I'm going to say this bluntly but gently. It's because, quite honestly, you just don't believe it yet. You don't believe in what I'm going to tell you. You don't believe in what God is telling us. You don't believe that. And it's not that you can't accept it as true. That's not what I mean. What I mean is you are not ready to commit to it absolutely and fully. That's what I mean, because that's what Jesus means when he talks about believe. And I understand some of it is timing. I'm not trying to give you a way out or license to be where you're at. I'm not trying to excuse anyone, myself included. But I do realize it's timing. Not everyone's on the same time schedule there. Okay, so it may take you some time to realize how much you need to trust in God and to what level you need to trust in God. And maybe you're there and maybe you're not. What I'm telling you, though, is that eventually, if you want to be with God, you've got to get to that point. And you don't have all the time in the world to do it. Having the desire to serve God is not the same thing as serving Him. Having the desire to change is not the same thing as having a conviction in change itself. Conviction is a desire that is so strong that it demands action, that you have to follow through with it. That's what a conviction is. A desire just simply says, hey, I want this. Okay? Everyone has a desire to win. Okay? Very few people should have a very strong conviction that they're going to win. All right? And that sort of thing. So we can look at desire and we can look at conviction and realize they're related, but they're not the same. So you can desire to change. And many people do. Many people know they need to eat better. They need to quit drinking, quit swearing, quit doing these things. They also need to know that they need to put time into study, more time into their prayer life, more time into their service. But at the core, they just don't want to give up yet who they are. So there's desire, which is kind of that superficial thing, which hasn't yet transformed into conviction, which is right at the core of where you're at. Because the desire is in the mind part. I desire. The conviction is in the heart. And that's where things start to change, is in the heart. Well, regardless, you can't possibly become something better than what you are now without changing who you are now. Doesn't that make sense? It's like that old adage, you can't keep doing the same thing over and over and expect different results or better results. You're going to have to change what you're doing in order to get those results. You can't possibly put on the new self unless you lay aside or until you lay aside the old self. Your mind can't be renewed with old thinking. And that's a lot of what we're talking about in this lesson, is the vestiges or the lingering effects of that old self and that old thinking that's a part of that. You got to lay that aside as well. You got to get that out in order for the heart to be converted and transformed there. All right, so we're going to look at all this. What is this old self? What do we mean by that? There's several ways of looking at it. I'm not saying that there's, what do we have here, four different things. I'm not saying that there's four different old selves. That's not what I'm saying. I'm saying there's different ways to look at this same subject here. And the first is the most obvious, and that is the proud, self-serving, unconverted, natural man of the world. And that's the ultimate sense of what old self means in Scripture, in the New Testament, because that's what's crucified when we united with Christ in the likeness of His crucifixion, which is all accomplished in our baptism, when we die with Christ in the water. That's our grave. That's where the old self is put to death, in that water, and the new self, of course, is resurrected there in that coming out of that water. Let's look at Romans chapter 6, verse 6 and 7, for example, where Paul's talking specifically about that. In baptism, that's the context, if you're going to back up, our old self was crucified with Him in order that our body of sin might be done away with, so that we would no longer be slaves to sin, for he who has died is free from sin. Now, there's some things we can gather from that, and there's also some misconceptions that we might have there too. First of all, look at the old self and look at the body of sin. It looks like they're the same thing, but really, they're not exactly the same. They're related, but different. The old self refers to the corrupted heart, whereas the body of sin refers to what you do in the body with respect to that corrupted heart. Okay? In other words, if your heart is corrupted, then you're going to manifest that corruption in certain behaviors. Doesn't that make sense? Just like if you have a clean heart or a pure heart, you're going to manifest that purity and that cleanness in certain behaviors. And those become visible because those are outward, visible behaviors. So that's what we, and we're not talking about what happens, you know, moment to moment. We're talking about as measured over time. But nonetheless, we're talking about the manifestation of that corruption in the ungodly life, ungodly habits, anti-Christian behavior, however you want to look at that. Okay? The driving mechanism of the old self, though, is allegiance. The old self has its allegiance to the world. The new self has its allegiance to Christ. And that's the big change. Baptism marks that dividing line or that separation from that old allegiance to that new allegiance. So that when we are baptized into Christ, then we are simply saying, as a historical event in our life, I used to be thus and so to God, and now I am a new creature to God. Who made that happen? Well, I made the decision, and I'm acting out the demonstration, but it's God who actually made the transformation. I hope that makes sense. And I hope that you see that. Let's read in 1 Corinthians chapter 2 for a moment here. 1 Corinthians chapter 2, we got a couple of verses to read that might add some more insight into that. 1 Corinthians 2, starting in verse 12 here, Paul says, "Now we have received not the spirit of the world, but the spirit who is from God," we being Christians here, "so that we may know the things freely given to us by God, which things we also speak, not in words taught by human wisdom, but in those taught by the Spirit, combining spiritual thoughts with spiritual words. But a natural man does not accept the things of the Spirit of God, for they are foolishness to him, and he cannot understand them because they're spiritually appraised." What you shouldn't get out of that is this, that when we become baptized, we become superior, enlightened people. And immediately coming out of the water, we know things that other people don't know. That's not true. We are not morally superior, and we are not mentally superior. We are not humanly superior people. What has changed is our relationship to God and our allegiance to God. That's what has changed, and that is superior. Because the natural man is still in his old allegiance to self and to the world, and he can't possibly appreciate, which is really what this is saying here, he can't appraise or appreciate the things of God stuck in that old mindset. He can know what they are intellectually, but he can't really benefit from them because they are foolishness to him as long as he wants to remain stuck in this over here. I hope that makes sense. It's very straightforward, really, if you think about it, and it's really not that complicated. The natural man, and by man we don't mean just men, okay, but people, the natural man is one whose heart is set upon this life and this world, whose God is his own desire, his own appetite, who's not yet given his allegiance to Christ. And that person doesn't have to be an excessively wicked person either. He's just simply someone who has not yet given his allegiance to the Lord. Or if he says that he hasn't demonstrated that, rather, in his act of obedience through baptism. So that's one aspect, and the biggest aspect of the old self, as far as if we could say the literal old self, if we could say it that way, and the rest of these are more symbolic in nature, but they're still very real. And the second thing we could say about the old self is it represents the immature spiritual life of a Christian who is a Christian, but still his life is cluttered with the worldly characteristics, the worldly thinking, and the sinful behavior that he's become accustomed to over the last however many, 5, 10, 20, 30, 50 years, okay? And he's accumulated a lot of stuff, a lot of garbage, a lot of thinking, a lot of habits, and that's not all going to just dissipate just because he was baptized. His allegiance changes, but the old self lingers on in the form of that old thinking and that old behavior. That's what I'm talking about. And I realize that that is in a symbolic sense because the actual old self was crucified at baptism, but that effect of the old self continues to linger until it is identified, until it is confronted, and then removed, which it has to be if you're going to be sincere about yourself. You have to identify it and strive to remove that. In Colossians chapter 3, verse 9, here's another place where Paul talks about this old self, new self thing. He says, "Don't lie to one another since you laid aside the old self with its evil practices." What you're looking at there is that you laid aside your allegiance to that old life, but here you are still lying to one another. That's old self thinking. That's old self mentality, and you can't possibly go forward with that because that defies what happened in your baptism. It contradicts that. And so as you see here, the influence, and when I use a phrase there, it's really powerful if you think about it, that mental memory of the old life. If you think about memory, you think about things that your mind or your body remembers. I play racquetball. I love the game. And sometimes when I'm swinging the racket there, or sometimes when I'm in a position and the ball's coming at me, I just react. I don't even think about it. And the reason I do so is not because I am just so lightning fast and superior person. And no, it's because I have trained my body to react that way over many, many games. I have a physical memory or even a mental memory of what to do so that my body does that automatically. Well, the same thing happens in a negative sense. If you've been having habits and lifestyle, values or whatever it is that you believe in, and if you've been practicing that for a long period of time, or even a few years, nonetheless, you've created a mental memory of that so that you default to that. And what you need to do then is stop that default reaction and step back and go, whoa, what am I doing that for? Okay, and recognize what's happening and then reprogram that so that you aren't going to be doing that, so that your default mental memory is no longer the old self, but now starts becoming the new self. That's what we're going to be talking about in a couple lessons to come here. But it's a powerful thing to think about, okay? So basically, you made a commitment to lay aside all the evil practices of the old self, but you haven't yet discovered what they are, or you haven't yet dealt with them fully and completely. That's another aspect of the old self. Here's another one. Any false perception of yourself that is different from the reality of who you are. And this is what we talked about last week. When we start saying phrases like, oh, I'm a good parent, I'm a good wife, I'm a good husband, I'm a good Christian, I'm a disciple, I'm faithful, I'm a believer, all, and we start using specific words like good and faithful and believer and things like that that really are being identified differently than how God identifies them, at least if we've gotten off track there. And so that's when we start using words, suppose I'm, for example, a lousy disciple or a lazy disciple or something like that, but I call myself a disciple nonetheless because, you know, after all, I've been baptized, I've been going to church for a long time, I know my Bible, and I sing songs and things like that, and that's what disciples do, and so that's what I am because of that's what I do. And so I characterize myself with that word. Well, that's not what Jesus said a disciple was by itself. But I stole the word, I hijacked the word, and now I've reinterpreted it, redefined it, and that's what I use. That is a perception of myself. That is not who I really am. Did you follow that? You can have a perception of yourself that you're a good moral person. Lots of people do. But that's not who you really are. Not in God's sight. If indeed you are defiant of His word, you're not obeying what He said to do, you are not a good person in God's sight. That doesn't mean there's no good about you or that you're not doing good things. It doesn't mean that. It means that you're still a sinner who is condemned by God and He's anxiously waiting for you to come to your senses and recognize the reality of your situation. Because you're not going to be saved by your perception of who you are. No one is saved by perceptions alone. Often we exercise self-protection because we want to keep propping up this propped up image of ourselves, which we want to project upon other people. And then we get one of two reactions. Typically, if I challenge who you think you are, then you're going to either get defensive or you're going to live in denial. In other words, you're going to get all ruffled up because I dared to challenge who you thought you were, and you get all, pretty uptight about that and bristling at that, and you think, how dare he say something like that when I know who I am? Well, you know who you think you are. Okay, and I'm gauging not what you think you are as the model or the standard, but rather what God says you are or says I am for that matter. Okay, so you might get defensive. And the second thing you might do is just simply say, well, that's not me. Obviously, he's talking about someone else. And I wonder if there isn't a lot of sermons that are lost on people who are thinking that I'm talking about somebody else. You know what I'm saying? And are pointing fingers in their mind to, oh, hope that guy down the pew, hope he's listening because this really does apply to him. Or hope my wife's listening, or hope my husband's listening, or hope my, friend here, the person I brought is listening because it really does apply to them. No, this really does apply to you, whoever you are. And so we might live in that denial stage, but either one of those is not good. Defensive and living in denial is not good. And that resistance, and that's really what that comes down to, is that resistance of truth about who we are and who we're not prevents us from drawing near to God, which prevents us from getting to that spiritual maturity that is so desperately needed in our life. The narrow way, the narrow path that leads to life is not going to accept your perceptions, your baggage, your issues, and certainly not your excuses. There's just no room for it. If you think about the narrow way, not as being just a narrow way where you're just having to put one foot in front of the other, okay? Not narrow just in that sense, but narrow as in constrictive. Like, I can only squeeze through these two big, you know, encumbrances here. I can only squeeze through and nothing can come with me. There's no room for my luggage. There's no room for my baggage. There's no room for anything else but me. Let me put it another way here that might make even more sense. Jesus is not saving the package of you that you created. You know, with all your issues and your traditions and your way of thinking and, you know, your value system and you're this and you're that. He's not saving that package of you. He's just saving you by yourself. The package needs to be stripped away and a new image, a new identity has to be taken up instead. And that new identity is really you in Christ. That's what needs to go. Go with him, that is. That's what he's saving. That he's saving not your perception of yourself. He's saving your reality. We could also say of the old self, in a sense, that it's really what you used to be. You say, well, when was I that old self? Well, last year, last month, last week, yesterday. Okay. And the reason I'm saying it this way is just to get us thinking about what we read in 2 Corinthians 4:16, which Doba read for us there. Therefore, we do not lose heart, but though our outer man is decaying, yet our inner man is being renewed. How often? Day by day. Every day it needs to be renewed. Why? Well, because it gets old left to itself, so to speak. Okay? I'm just thinking about how we look at things. It indicates one's heart growing closer to God every day, and that means you have to be moving. You have to be in motion. And in order for you to be in motion, it means that you have to leave behind the older thinking, the older ways, the older self, and moving on into the new self, being renewed every day. The point here is that if renewal is a daily action necessitated by daily decisions that you need to be renewed, that is, then it stands to reason that what needs to be renewed is already fading, inferior, and in need of replacement there. And what that means is, regardless of how spiritual-minded or Christ-like or forward-moving you were a year ago, you're expected to excel still more and keep moving forward. You say, well, that's a lot of work, and I don't know if I can do that. Actually, you don't do it all by yourself. You make the decision to do it, and you do your part, and God does what you can't do, and that's called grace. Whenever God steps in and does what you can't do but is necessary to be done, it's called grace. I have a great little example of that. You know, when you go to the airport, I don't know if we even have them at Seattle, but some of the other airports, Chicago and Houston and others, they're big airports, and they have these little moving walkways, right? And they're really fun to get on to, especially if you walk backward. It looks like you're standing still. Anyway, so the idea is that you get on those things, and you can walk on those pretty briskly, and you can be watching people who are walking outside of that moving walkway, and you're walking the same pace they're walking, but you're moving faster. Well, why is that? Because something other than you is also moving you forward. Think about that idea now in terms of God's grace. Even when you walk your very best, you're walking briskly there and you think, hey, I'm doing great. Well, God is moving you faster than that. And even in those times when you're not walking very fast because you're struggling and you're beset with all kinds of problems and spiritual angst and everything else, and you just feel like, God, I trust you, I believe in you, but I'm just going through a real difficult time, he's still moving you. You're still going forward. Does that make sense? It helped me. I don't know if it helped you, but it was a neat little illustration I was thinking of as far as making it make sense to me here, okay? You feel like you're accomplishing something, and you are, but God's doing even more. He's doing more, and he doesn't have to tell you everything he's doing, and you don't have to see it in order for it to be happening. Unfortunately, many people don't realize how limiting and thus how damaging old self-thinking really is. And therefore, we tend to be very passive toward that. Oh, I know, I've got some issues, but I've learned to live with them. And I want to tell you that sinful behavior is not an issue. It is a violation of God's holiness. It is a sin, and you cannot find a place for that in the new life. It has no place for sin. There is nowhere to put it. You have to deal with it and get rid of it. So don't be passive about that. But then we tend to rationalize. I know I've got some issues, or I got this thing, but that's just the way I am. Implying then that, and therefore it's impossible for me to change. But worldly thinking and sinful habits and a rebellious attitude must be changed. Otherwise, God is wrong, because he said that they can be changed. And Jesus' sacrifice doesn't do anything, because he sacrificed himself in order that you could be changed. And thirdly, you lied to God when you were baptized, because you said that you would change. There's just no good way around that. This whole "that's the way I am" needs to be. That's old self thinking. There's no way to rationalize that. But then we tend to overgeneralize, like, well, everybody's got problems, and, you know, nobody's perfect, and all that kind of nonsense there. That just evades or minimizes the real nature of the problem. We're told in James 4:17, if anyone knows the right thing to do and doesn't do it, to him it is sin. You can't look at that and go, yeah, I know, but lots of people are not doing the right thing. Well, then it's sin to them too. But it's also sin for you, and you can't escape that. This whole nobody's perfect mentality doesn't work. So I thought what we do here, and this is where it seems to be a little negative, but what I'm really trying to do is being more specific, because staying general doesn't help us to understand really what's going on here. So I want to show you the effects, or the examples rather, of limiting, damaging, growth-stunting states of mind associated with the new self. Here's just a sampling of those. And look at what some of these are. You might see some of yourself in all this. I don't know. I hope not, but maybe you do. I'm going to read it just for those on listening to the CD later can get the benefit of that. But being competitive, being complaining, blaming others, moral confusion, being distracted. And I'm talking about distracted from what is important, of course. Self-pitying, fearful, anxious, having a poor self-image, being self-absorbed, being hypersensitive, being overly dramatic. I think we all know what we're talking about there, right? Overly emotional and all that stuff. Being needy or quick to judge or overconfident or conceited or controlling or deceptive or dishonest or defensive or undisciplined, impatient, evasive, irresponsible. These are some of the old self-thinking processes that are going on in that old self mindset. In other words, what I'm saying is you can be baptized into Christ and still be thinking these things. And when you're thinking these things, you're going to act them out. I'll tell you that in just a minute, okay? But really what we're addressing right now is when we think like the old self, we do act it out, because it affects our behavior, it affects our choices, it affects our lifestyle, it affects the people we choose to surround ourselves with, it also affects the people that we choose to avoid, because we don't like their, looking into our life and exposing us for who we really are, so we just avoid them. And it also affects our self-protection, because self-protection is a huge part of all of this. And that self-protection is when we get into that defensive mode or that living in denial mode. That's all part of self-protection. In other words, how we think directly corresponds to how we act. So we can actually use reverse engineering, so to speak, by observing patterns of behavior. I'm talking about patterns of behavior, not one-time things, but patterns of behavior. We can also predict with great amount of accuracy what's going on in the mind. I can tell you, in other words, what kind of thinking you've adopted and have maintained simply by watching your patterns over time. You say, well, because you're such a morally superior person, right? No, it has nothing to do with that. I'm just going by what Jesus says, that you will know people by their fruits. You will know who they are genuinely by the output, the product of what they've been thinking about as it's manifested in behavior. Simple, basic psychology, but also biblical truth. So let's look at some examples of those actions and behaviors that result from that old self-thinking. And there's a bunch of them. Okay, I'm not going to spend a lot of time. I'm just going to read them here. But sulking and feeling sorry for yourself, purposely distancing and disconnecting yourself from others. Why? Well, because you feel sorry for yourself and you're busy sulking, okay? Or you feel inferior. Overeating and other addictive behavior as a means of coping with this self-inflicted depression. Lots of people say, oh, I feel so depressed. A lot of that self-inflicted is not a chemical issue. It's a chosen issue. Or just to gossip and perpetuate rumors because it makes you not because you've got something to offer, but always because they're feeding you. Spending excessive time at the computer or on your iPhone or on your iPad or watching TV because, quite frankly, you're lazy and you want to avoid doing what you're supposed to do and you choose to do this because it's easy. Taking the path of least resistance. Saying mean and hurtful things to someone you love because, why? You can get away with it. Or at least you think you can. Indulging in secret sin or self-destructive behavior. Refusing to be responsible for your own actions. Reneging on promises. Failing to keep your commitments. Procrastinating. Making excuses. Lying about yourself to yourself or to others. Yelling or getting upset at the slightest provocation there. Manipulating others to get what you want. Being a codependent person or being an enabler to someone in their irresponsibility. Playing the victim card in order to get emotional sympathy and pity from other people. Treating fellow Christians with disrespect, especially to vindicate yourself or maybe to show that you know more than them and that you're somehow superior to them. Or speaking condescendingly to those who you regard as inferior. Boasting, talking about yourself, and therefore seldom listening. Always seeking time to be with popular people so you can use that as a bragging point later on. Trying to be the center of attention. Or always talking about the past and what happened that so upset you and who hurt you. And this is just the short list. We could keep going here. What I'm trying to do is give you actual behavioral symptoms that are simply the product of that old self-thinking that manifests itself in some of these ways. So if you claim to be the new self, and yet what I just described there is some of your regular behavior, your habitual knee-jerk default reaction behavior, what I'm telling you is you've got some of that old self-thinking that's still being kept alive because I can see it, and you can see it in me if I'm doing that. You shall know them by their fruits. These are some of the fruits. And in this case, they're not good fruit. They're bad fruit, okay? What good is a fruit tree that bears bad fruit? You may not be doing these things even intentionally, but if you're doing them at all, then you're simply manifesting a projection of what is going on within you. And remember, we're talking about patterns here. We're not talking about one time. For example, if you see me yelling or getting upset at something small, oh, he's got old school thinking, old self-thinking going on there. And it's like, no, I just got mad and I just lost it for a minute, okay? And that can happen, and I'm not trying to excuse that, but that doesn't manifest a pattern. But if this is how I always act, if I'm always doing this, that's a pattern. Okay, now I've set in motion a pattern, and that it manifests what's going on. Someone says, well, I don't have any of those things. Well, I'm not saying you do. On the other hand, you might be the one in denial. You might be the one who is blinded to your own reality. You might be oblivious. Really, how we can test this is find out, what would your wife say? What would your husband say? What would your children say? What would your coworkers say? What about the people in your congregation? What would they say about you? That's where we really test this. It's not just what you say. Your face value appraisal of yourself, okay, I appreciate that, but it's very limited, okay? What we really need to do is see the people who are seeing you and talk to them if we needed to, right? If we needed to find an objective view. And if you want to test that yourself, if you're brave enough, then go up to one of these people, especially like your wife or your husband, and say, hey, did you see me in there? And they might go, we need to talk. Okay, or something like that. Or they may say, you know what, you do these things occasionally, but that's not, I don't see that as a pattern. Okay, then you can be rest assured that either both of you are oblivious to what's going on, or just you are doing pretty well there, right? When we allow this kind of old self-thinking to remain and we grow comfortable with those habits and that manifestation, then we develop an identity that contradicts what we ought to have as Christians. The new self that was created in righteousness and holiness of the truth, as Paul says in Ephesians 4, that is in contrast to what we just saw here. In essence, we keep the old self alive. We resurrect it from the dead, brush it off, clean it up, so we can still use that. But that was supposed to be put to death and not resurrected. We give life and energy to the kind of person and personality that has nothing in common with Christ or Christianity when we do that. In other words, it's backward, completely backward to what we need to be doing. In Ephesians 4:20, remember what Paul said, you did not learn Christ in this way. In other words, that worldly, carnal, self-serving life of the unconverted cannot be married to or carried over into that holy, righteous, pure life of a Christian follower. I was doing some reading here this last week, came across this quote from Dietrich Bonhoeffer in his book, The Cost of Discipleship, and he's pretty blunt and straightforward, but he says, in baptism, the breach with the world is complete. It demands and produces the death of the old man. In baptism, a man dies together with his old world. When a man is baptized into the body of Christ, not only is his personal status as regards salvation changed, but also the relationship of daily life. And he's not saying anything different than what we've been reading. He just says it a little bit differently that might strike a chord with you differently then. Okay? That last part is the important part. Not only has our salvation changed, or what affects our salvation, but so must our daily life change. Otherwise, we jeopardize that salvation. And that is important to keep in mind. So we might ask the question, well, why would a person continue in that old self-thinking, especially if it's been pointed out? There's several reasons for that. First of all, they just don't know any better. They don't see themselves in that new life state of being. They just, so far, it's all they know is this comfortable, familiar part of their identity that's taken years to craft and put together, and they just can't imagine themselves as anything different. Or, as we said in our first lesson this year, they made a commitment to change their mind, but they never really changed their heart. They were convinced by what they know to be true, that's the mental thing, but they lack as yet the will and desire to actually do what is necessary to put that into practice. And that's where I'm saying that some of you may be, as I said in the onset of this lesson, you may believe what needs to be done, but you haven't yet put it into practice because you don't believe in it to the extent that you need to. Or a person might be convinced that he cannot change. That's just the way I am. Or he's allowed others to convince him that he cannot change. You've been that way for 20 years. You're always going to be, thus and so. And he allows that, tape recorder to keep going over in his mind, like, you're always going to be the same. You're always going to be the same. You're always going to be the same. And it just keeps hitting on that endless loop, and he believes it. Or he's addicted to the rush of sin, the passion of pride, the thrill of the taboo. In other words, those worldly thoughts and that worldly behavior, quite frankly, is intoxicating. And it gives him a feeling of being alive. And without that rush, without that addiction, he feels like he's dead or numb or perhaps even insignificant. But here's where it all comes together. This is the bottom line of it all. Quite frankly, he just doesn't yet believe in the power that God possesses to transform his heart. If he would surrender his heart and give his will over to God, then God says, I can give you far better things of anything that you've left behind. But he just doesn't yet believe it, and therefore he just won't let go of it. So we've got some issues going on here. We've got a control issue. We've got a trust issue. And really we have a belief issue. And those things are standing in the way of what needs to be done. Much more could be said on all this. I'm not here to dwell on all that stuff there, but I'm trying to define what's happening so that we can deal with it. Not just so we can say, oh, I feel, and some of you will come up to me afterward, oh, you stepped all over my toes. Well, as we've said before, the reason why your toes got stepped on is because your feet are in the wrong place. You're not on the path where you need to be. And it's not me trying to accuse you. It's just simply there's a variance. There's a non-agreement. God says you need to be here, and you're here, and That hurts when we see that, when we finally recognize that, that hurts. The good news is there is a way of escape from all this old thinking, from all that sinful behavior. And no matter what it is or how ingrained it is in you or how long you've been practicing, there is a way of escape because Christ is more powerful than the world and all of that. He's more powerful than that. And Christ didn't come to give you just a different form of misery, right? That's what people think religion is sometimes, a different form of misery than what they had before. He came to bring you forgiveness and peace and with all that, hope. He gave you hope in this gospel. That's what he wants to give to you now. To lose your soul would be the very worst thing that could ever happen to anyone. The very worst thing. And yet that is entirely avoidable and preventable. Christ has done everything necessary to rescue you from that horrible loss and at the same time to bring you into this righteous relationship with the Father himself. That's the good news. And that's good indeed. And yet, you can't combine what stands opposed to Christ with that holy life that he's calling us into. You can't combine those two things. They are incompatible. You can't pursue the new self until you sever ties with the old self and all of its baggage. And you can't become thinking that new way of thinking until you abandon that old way of thinking. The way that leads to life will not accommodate your old thinking. It won't accommodate your rationalizing or my excuses or my issues or my behaviors or my habits. Not accommodating any of that. What you and I need to do then is to trust God and believe in his grace that he is able to deliver you from that old life and at the same time usher you into a new life because that's what he wants for you. That's a good thing. It's a positive thing. It not only changes your eternity, it changes your world that you're living in right now, as far as you're concerned. It doesn't matter what's going on out there. What matters is this in here is at peace with God. And then it doesn't matter what happens anywhere else. And that's what he's trying to do, is to get you to see that you can have that peace with God if you would just trust him. We'll talk about the new life next week, and we'll get into all that. But for now, if there's anyone here that is subject to our traditional invitation as we offer it, if you want to become a Christian, this would be a time that you can make that known. Or if you just have been struggling with the old life and the old self, and you just realize that, and you're going to make a commitment to change, maybe you need to make that commitment public, if that's what helps you. Whatever your need is, let us help you if you'll let us. Certainly we can pray for you and encourage you as we stand and sing the song Richard has selected.